You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, surprisingly enough, and today is the 8th of June, 2022. The first thing I want to comment on is the merchandise sales. So the sales are going very well, but what is, and of course the website will also be in the description just like it was last week. But what we have available now, which was designed by Jason Augustus, by the way, some of you may know that, this isn't going to be the only things we offer. This is just an introductory offering. Within a few weeks, there's going to be new designs and new things. Essentially what we're going for is, you know, a rock band t-shirt or hoodie or whatever. That style, but with things that we're interested in. You know, John of Kronstadt or Tsar Nicholas II, the emblem for the Black Hundreds, Cossack stuff, all of their symbolism and emblems. I've been collecting these graphics for so long that I just have an infinite number of ideas. And for each, you know, period of time, we're going to sell a very specific design. Usually one thing, and of course we'll keep the other things around, so it'll build up over time. Tsar Nicholas II, of course, is very, very popular, and this is why we need your input in the website, the email, the Orthodox Nationalist at Gmail, to see what's going to sell. You know, no one is bothering to fill this pretty substantial market, and it's essentially a way to, you know, show this militancy to the world. And the funny part is, of course, they're so benighted that they're not going to have any idea the symbols and the things you have on your stuff. So the Orthodox Nationalist logo, I mean, I've had many logos over the years designed by friends, but this is one of my favorites, which is out now, and that was Jason's idea, which he sent really pretty much out of nowhere. And he's one of the few people you can trust. He was with me in Charlottesville. He was hurt with me, not quite as badly, but he was right behind me. And it's you know, this is it's been a success so far. I thank everyone who's joined my Patreon, who's bought things, who's donated through my the new donation channel, which is all over the place. And don't forget too, on my theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com site, I also have a Bitcoin wallet. Now, I'm no expert in that world yet. I know guys like Matt Parrott have been into it for a very long time, but I'm tracking the price, and it just seems to go up and down in almost equal measure, you know, as the weeks go by. So one of these days, I'll get to fully understand the nature of this. I guess at the moment I don't care enough. But as the dollar, you know, just treads its race to the bottom, this alternative currencies and cryptos, real crypto, I mean, there's nothing more ridiculous than a credit card company using, you know, MasterCard or Visa, talking about it being powered by crypto. Well, crypto, by definition, means secret. That's what the word means. So you can't have MasterCard putting out a crypto card. Many of you are aware what happened with the GameStop stock. I guess that was last year sometime. And the minute that happened, it scared the crap out of the oligarchs in this country, that suddenly they tried to take the market over. Now, we all predicted that. That's not exactly a shocker. But when that market which again, as crypto suggests, is non-traceable. The GameStop, they crashed it, they manipulated it, this huge store of value that the regime really didn't focus on, showed its power. And then all of a sudden, immediately, all of a sudden you had, it was on front page news, and the credit card companies are now offering us using crypto, using the term as a new marketing tool, you know, devaluing it like it does everything it touches. And so point is, I do have that wallet, and you want to use that to donate to me, that'll be great too. Who knows, maybe we'll get a spike. I got like, you know, I have a few $100 in there now. So however you help me, this is great. I have two books coming out. Actually, no, I have three books coming out. The Nominalism book, which I've already said is in process. The overwhelming majority of the work is finished. Then there's a book on China as National Socialist rather than Communist, which is something that desperately needs. I've been saying this from, you know, for 20 years now, thanks to Willis Cardo, who was the first to bring that up to me. And the third is, you know, sometimes books come together because I've been writing on something for so long, I don't realize I have a book length of material. And the third one I haven't mentioned yet is debunking two things. You know, I have the book on Latin American dictators who are so understudied. Very few people can name more than one or two. And they're understudied because they were National Socialists in one form or another. That's how they saw themselves, be Perón or Velasco. And they're simply condemned out of hand. They're dismissed out of hand. And there is no real English positive treatment of these guys. So that's roughly 100 pages, I think. And this one is similar to that in that it's debunking two things. The Bodo League massacre during the Korean War and the My Lai massacre during Vietnam. The former is almost completely unknown. The latter is not. They're myths and stories created by the regime because there is not a single right-wing leader, military or otherwise, on this planet that has not been condemned by the regime as a whole as this evil genocidal institution. So they're lying. They use the same language, the same nonsense. The U.S. did not support these people, you know, with the exception of Thieu in South Vietnam, and even that was very problematic. They condemned them, as I proved in my Latin America book, that they want weak banana republics that they could take over. The last thing the CIA wants is a military government. You go through all the WikiLeaks that have come out now as to what the CIA thought of these places, and these leaders, and they hated them, or at most were negatively ambivalent. And they claim, well, CIA documents prove otherwise, and of course no one actually reads these things. Well, I read these things. And so these so-called massacres were made up. They were invented. And the point was to humiliate and destroy any anti-communist movement anywhere. So in the process of debunking these two myths, I deal with this phenomenon. Wherever you go, any government, especially military government in the 60s and 70s, that took over and fought the communist guerrillas was immediately and instantaneously condemned by the regime the world over. And very little work is done on them. For Marxists and communists, you have works of theory and you have, you know, studies. And for the military guys, there's nothing, despite them being probably even theoretically more sophisticated than people like Tito or Stalin, for that matter. So I have three things coming. And so when they come out, you're going to be the first to know. And it seems that the Nominalism book, I mean, I have to put this out, finally. You know, I'm just kind of sick of it now. And it's going to be a very definitive book, as far as my thinking is concerned. Anyway, that all being said, the topic today, and we hinted at this not last week, but 2 weeks ago, when we talked about the Varangian Guard. And where they came from and why they came into existence. And we're going to be doing something similar to that. And that is studying the political theory of Olav of Norway, the man who created modern Norway in the Middle Ages, who Christianized the area, and whose cult, not just his own actions, but his veneration as a saint right after his death, with immense popular fervor, created and centralized the Norwegian identity as something apart from the Finns on the one hand and apart from Sweden on the other. This is how God creates nations, not nations in the sense of ethnic groups, but nations in the sense of an armed ethnic group. An ethnic group, ethnic groups have always existed. They've been very important historically. But when they become politicized and are properly led and have a unifying ideology, which back then, of course, always was Orthodoxy or some variant of Catholicism, and this is prior to the general period of the schism, it becomes a nation. It takes, you know, groups of nobles and communes speaking one language and inhabiting a vaguely similar topography and having an economy that unifies them and gives that political expression. This is how they come into existence. And that balance between local control and the beginning of empire is really where nations sit as a medium between those two. This is ultimately, you know, the historical trajectory, not, as the regime will tell you, mindless globalization. And we know that this is the case because the regime spends billions of dollars a month doing everything it can to humiliate and destroy and delegitimize nations of any kind whatsoever. And that fits into the stuff these right-wing nationalist dictators being condemned automatically, even before they know anything about them. You know, academics and journalists are so stupid that they'll condemn an entire system, an entire government, without knowing the first thing about it. But that's typical. You know, when you're a leftist, you live in a bubble. You don't hear your opposition. Everything is cowed into silence or banned, or censored. So you really start thinking that your point of view is the only point of view. And therefore, anything that... And it's not really their point of view. They've adopted what was available. It's not theirs at all, and they're probably not capable of a rational point of view. They start thinking that that's it, and this is the entire world. So therefore, anyone who comes from the outside must be insane, which was a Soviet model of psychiatry, which one day we're going to get to. I hinted at it before, but we'll get to it more significantly. So when I say the unification of Norway, and many, many years ago, some of you may remember my work on the National Romantics. And that phrase was a phrase I used to describe myself for a long time. National Romantics were from Scandinavia, Norway in particular. And they go back and really dug back into the life of St. Olaf. And the Anglicization is O-L-A-V. Rather than O-L-A-F. Some of the English translators many years ago, you see how with the Russian V at the end of the last name is replaced by two Fs. That's 19th century stuff. And that's where Olaf came from. It's O-L-A-V. So when we're talking about the unification of Norway or anything else, we're not just talking about the creation of a state. You know, we're not Mussolini supporters here. The state is, in fact, a product of something else. And, of course, back then, the state was much smaller and much more representative. And it was a church, of course, that was that gave the content to the form of the state, to be simplistic about it. So it's not just an ethnic group, but it's an ethnic group in very specific circumstances that then gets politicized and brought to the historical stage because of someone like Olaf of Norway, and with something like Orthodoxy, not a vague Christianity that has always irritated me. The Christian is, no, it's not vague Christianity. There is no such thing. Because of heresy, because of sin, there are very specific manifestations. Roman Catholicism and Orthodoxy are extremely different from one another, politically in every other way. Protestantism isn't anything because it's whatever you want, so we can't even really talk about it as a sect at all. But so these are very specific expressions whether Orthodoxy or some version of Catholicism, better expresses this nation. And ever since the death of Olav in 1030, there's been a separate Orthodox idea of Norway. And St. Olav brought, and this, you know, what we're talking about here is the Christianization of the Vikings. We have enemies out there who call themselves some variant of racialism who think they know something about paganism. Now, I've never heard any satisfactory definition of what a pagan is. And there's never going to be one, because pagan is just this very, you know, vague catch-all term, something that isn't, you know, Catholic or Islamic or Judaic, something that falls out of those categorizations. And that somehow racialism is harmed. And this is very passive. Very passive and very violent at the same time. Our enemies always say that. It's the slave religion on the one hand, and it created violent empires on the other. I don't know how those two things can be the same, or can exist at the same time, but that's they claim these aren't very bright people. And, of course, they know nothing about the history and development of these things. Vikings only became a productive part of the world under Olav. Because prior to that, they didn't form nations or states. They were gangs, very ferocious gangs. Made a lot of money in some cases, but they never created a state. They never created a nation. They never really did much productive until civilization came to Northern Europe. Olaf created a new idea of the crown, a combination of the Orthodox idea of monarchy on the one hand, and the very specific life of the Vikings and the ordinary people of Scandinavia on the other. He wanted to strike a balance, as all national leaders do, between local control on the one hand and a centralized military and religious apparatus on the other. That's a tremendous, very difficult balance to maintain. And back then, it took a very strong leader. We talked about Basil II, now I'm talking about Olav. It takes someone like that to force this out of the chaos of politics in this era. And it was in 1024, we'll talk about that in a minute, the 1024 parliament that created a Orthodox Norway in union with Novgorod in Russia, which really Olav was very closely connected to. One issue that I have to bring up now are sources. Sources continue to be a problem, especially in a non-literate society, which Norway was prior to Olav. The history of essentially the ancient kings of Norway by Theodoric the Monk, who died in 1188, so a bit more than 100 years after Olav, is a main source. After that, you have the sagas that were written about him. The Fagrskinna from roughly 1230, and several others. And the oldest saga of St. Olaf, which came out around 1200. 1210, maybe. And they use the skaldic verses. So they're not strict histories in our sense of the term. But that doesn't mean they don't have valuable information. People like Fairhair, you know, you only have poetic. He briefly unified Norway a couple of centuries earlier. And I stress the word brief. And there's not a whole lot known about him because of the nature of the sources. It's a little different for Olaf because he was connected with both the Russian and the Greek worlds. Whenever you adopt one of the great religions, for better or for worse, you then have inserted yourself into the main line of history at the time. His battle, and you need to remember, Olaf was one of the great men of Scandinavian history. And like all great men, they cut their teeth on the fact that they're usually surrounded by enemies, not the least of which were, of course, internal ones. and it was his wars against Canute, who, as you know, created the North Sea Empire with Britain and Sweden. Yeah, great leaders are, for better or for worse, forged in warfare, either rhetorical on the one hand, ideological, or typical warfare with armies and navies on the other. Remember, there's nothing wrong with violence. Violence itself isn't a problem. It's who does it and why, what legal authority do they have, what moral authority do they have, what is their end goal, you know. Terrorism is immoral by definition, because there are none of those authorities in doing this. The goal is often very vague and covers up more nefarious agendas. But so many of the great nations in history were forged in warfare. The Old Testament is filled with warfare. Christianity accepts that sort of violence as a moral necessity. It's not automatically incorrect. Orthodoxy and Catholicism grew because of the empires that it helped found. The state was never large enough, and I'm using the state in a very vague way here, was never large enough to have its own moral code. That was left to the church. So the centralization of a country like Norway or anywhere else is brought about by a unification via the church. Like all of these leaders, Norway was in such a unique position, because it had a fairly low population, and it had a low population because you had very little arable land. There's something along the lines of Greece or Japan, or even Iceland. They have that in common. So that means they're going to create an extremely industrious, very disciplined population, because that's the only way you're going to survive. As we talked about with the Vikings 2 weeks ago, because you didn't have much arable land, the economy was only so big in a place that's mostly rocks and based on seafaring, the noble family simply got too large. So you had very industrious, very disciplined nobles with nothing to do. And this is at least one theory as to where the Vikings came from. In all these cases, whether the war against Sweden or the war against Canute, or even the war against the petty kings that remained in, remember, much of Norway was under Sweden. And the Swedish-Norwegian rivalry is a very ancient one. But you also had much smaller, weaker kings that either threw in their lot with Olaf or threw in their lot with Sweden. Olaf had a lot of support because of not only his ability to do business, but his ability to conduct raids and warfare. And he did this quite a bit. Everyone who wanted to become anything in Norway had to do this. This simply wasn't a matter of morality. It was a matter of survival. But to have one leader with a new ideology that sought to cut through class warfare and the feudalism of the era, and Olaf was very anti-feudal in the way he thought about the state, he's going to have a lot of enemies. And he survived many assassination attempts. And one of the significant aspects of Olaf's rule is that he went to St. Yaroslav in Novgorod for assistance. And this is the foundation, not so much of his becoming some vague Christian, but of becoming Orthodox. And of seeing the Russians as, and to a lesser extent, the Anglo-Saxons of England, both together as models to follow. Canute is someone who I haven't talked about in a very, very long time. He's a very ambiguous ruler, empire builder, because very much like William later on, he wiped out a good portion of the Anglo-Saxon nobility, creating the Earl, which was, you know, a group of petty rulers beholden to him. Anyway, following Canute's example, though, and localizing it in Norway, and seeing St. Olaf and Novgorod, and even some of the Baltics as examples, he helped urbanize parts of Norway, and, for lack of a better phrase, modernizing the economy, taking the old law code, which is often in poetic form, and bringing it within the Orthodox canonical statute, and hence natural law. just like in Russia and in most early medieval places, the appanage, or the more or less independent fiefdom, needed to be overcome. You can't really have a nation. This is something that Ivan the Terrible faced. Ivan III, Basil III, they all faced this problem of an arrogant, independent oligarchy with large land holdings that was beholden to nobody. In fact, they would side with anyone who would protect their holdings. This is why Novgorod was so troublesome, and Pskov was so troublesome to Russian monarchs. So it's not a matter of just defeating Canute, of defeating the Swedes, of defeating the Balts, you know, of defeating his enemies, whether it be in England or in Sweden, but also in pacifying, not just pacifying militarily his own people, but in also convincing them that he is the one they should bet their fortunes on. And unfortunately for him, most of the old Viking elite bet on Knut, who always remained, despite later on being a fairly just man, still maintained himself as a Viking. And of course, the legitimate English royal family ran to the, at least initially, Viking Duchy of Normandy in France. The war with Sweden, of course, as all this is going on, is pretty much constant. But there's one aspect of law that Olaf thought was consistent with natural law and with orthodoxy, whether it be Russian or otherwise, and that was a law can't really respect persons. It isn't as if, not natural law may sanction classes in the sense of functions. I'm not talking about income. Estates might be a better word. Yeah, that is certainly sanctioned by natural law. There's no society that ever existed that didn't have that. But the law being based on it is a separate matter. The law being based on estates is pretty much what oligarchy is. To have a single natural law and a single standard of justice where everyone has a separate but very important function, that's a different story. And when you're building a nation rather than just a set of fiefdoms, in a chaotic set of fiefdoms, this is how you have to go about it. He did not respect persons. He took, very much like Saint Vladimir in Kiev, you know, he took orthodoxy as almost purchasing, and that's not literal, of course, purchasing your salvation by giving to the poor. He gave much of his fortune to the poor, as did Saint Vladimir. In the old custom in most Eastern royal household, St. John Chrysostom talks about this, actually, and bringing the poor in to the various feasts over the course of the year. People who would have nothing are brought in and given the best pieces. St. Vladimir and St. Olaf both did this. That also was consistent with natural law. Knut, as he built the North Sea Empire, functioned largely by high taxation. He functioned by high taxation, owning tremendous estates himself, and monetized at least the urban parts of the economy. London was always based on cash rather than kind or labor. Monetizing an economy is usually a bad thing in the Middle Ages because it does create an actual moneyed elite. But someone with the strength of Knut can tax that group. His forces were always very well paid. And it's not an exaggeration to say that Knut, I don't have time to get into every detail here, but that Knut bribed many of Olaf's forces, that the elite bet on him because it was a very good financial circumstance. And because of this, Olaf was forced to go to Russia, was supposed to go to the wealthiest city in Russia for a long time. Of course, that's Novgorod. And his mission and his struggle was tightly connected there. He used troops from this area, and Canute always made the claim, the Swedes did the same thing, that, well, you know, he's going to turn the country over to the Russians as soon as he wins. And given what Olaf wanted, it was clear that that wasn't the case, obviously. But it was a rumor that they spread, this kind of very crude propaganda. Olaf, when he had one of his confrontations with Canute, he faced the 15,000 seasoned guys, with his own roughly 3,600 men. Now, knowing the story of Gideon, my favorite of the Old Testament judges, you know, Gideon fought the Midianites with the colonial empire, and Olaf saw himself as somehow connected with Gideon here, and this story proves it, purged his army of pagans. This is what God, in the Old Testament, this is what God did with Gideon. Gideon was ordered by God to reduce his army to the absolute bare minimum, despite going after the Midianite Empire. But he realized that the paganism and orthodoxy, that distinction was everything today. And he could not have pagans, whatever the hell that is, or non-Christians, I guess you can say, in his army, because they would be susceptible to bribery. Canute ultimately was a Christian, and at least in the medieval Benedictine books I have, he is listed as a saint there. Although that's always been very curious to me. But he realizes that the old elite who were, you know, venerators, remember that got very complicated, the so-called religious expression of the place before Olaf, but they became susceptible to their influence. Ultimately, he lowered his army to about 1,500. And that's when Canute started spreading this rumor, because a lot of his forces either had been trained or actually came from Russia. Now, despite all of this, he was, at heart, he was pacifistic. But that was simply impossible. In fact, his own conscience said, we can't. Violence is absolutely necessary. Independence and a free church and all this stuff is paid for in blood, as you see in the Old Testament. Circumstances forced him, very much like Marcus Aurelius, who he resembles in certain ways, to take the militant tack. There's simply no way to defending hearth and home. There's simply no other way to do it. And he was convinced, as so many rulers like St. Vladimir and so many others at the time, that the confusing, the pagan cults, which was always differing, the stories were always changing, was no way, that was not a foundation for a nation. A nation has to have the church and natural law as a single unchanging canonical basis. But even after, you know, he was genuinely a popular man for this reason, and smashing feudalism, he built, you know, both the according to natural law and the canons, as well as his, you know, the discipline of the Norwegians to begin with, this very strict and yet very impartial justice that he was known for. This is why, right after his death, when his relics were found incorrupt, and there was a few people who were very upset by this, so there's no question they were. And some of his opponents pretended it wasn't going on, but he was still ruddy in complexion and had long fingernails. 1 year after his death, which is not surprising given where there's not a whole lot of places to bury anyone there, his cult became very, very, very popular. It was not just his institutions that unified Norway, but him. His life, the sources I mentioned before, the earliest one comes from 1170. He died in 1030, which in medieval terms means that these are very trustworthy accounts. But even with all that, the church instituted an order and literacy in the introduction of philosophy and natural law such that they had never known before. I don't want to use the word Romanized, but in a very indirect way, that's what happened. He took the sign, this is the mere, the monasteries always did this, wherever they went, he took the old sagas and the stories and the poems and all the verses and unified them and brought them into one place. The only reason you have the pre-Christian great poets is that the church preserved them and the church venerated them as followers of the natural law before Christ came to complete it. So it isn't just a matter, he didn't simply just condemn all this stuff like the ignorant would want you to believe. He, however, did collect it all. Otherwise, it would have all been lost by now. It's really hard to preserve poetry and the sagas in a non-literate society. But in the process of doing that, he defined, I should say, redefined the nature of sovereignty. The terms like sovereignty often were to be found in the person of an emperor, which under certain circumstances may make sense, but that's too narrow. He defines sovereignty as a political order that was free from class rule. And to transform the rule of money and power and the rule of the strongest into a functional interdependence, the way Hegel talks about in the philosophy of right. Now, he had to finance himself, of course, and given the local economy was incapable of financing anything, he did raid the Baltic, making enemies out of them. And he received tribute this way. Unfortunately, if you were a Viking prince of any type, this is how you had to finance yourself. Knut was certainly doing it on a much greater scale than he was. And just like in Greece and Japan, very similar countries, the control of the sea was absolutely essential. Now, as far as the pagans are concerned, the cults from... Must remember how far south the Vikings went. The cult of the Magi had penetrated northern paganism. Norwegian paganism was, in fact, by this time, dominated by this. I didn't know this until just a few years ago, that the cults of Moloch and Astarte that we talked about last week had penetrated the northern regions and had influenced very negatively the development of Norwegian paganism. This is something that some of our enemies don't fully understand. By the time Olaf wouldn't have been successful in replacing the slave class rule of that version of paganism with orthodoxy, if it wasn't already in the later stages of its decay. Because of the Vikings squandering this wealth, the creation of a involuntarily monetized economy from these raids, the very same vices that we talked about with Ezekiel and Isaiah had penetrated the ruling classes of Northern Europe. These are things that were brought back from the Black Sea region, from Khazaria itself. Now, and this is based, of course, this is based on slavery and class rule. And it's on that ground, and it was, in other words, it existed to justify that system. And this is why Olaf strongly rejected all of this, rejected that Middle Eastern and Central Asian, you know, pagan, eventually became the Kabbalah, and realized that equity and centralization was really the only cure. The way things were in Norway at the time, whether under Sweden or locally, prior to Olaf, even prior to Fairhair, you didn't have a lot of land. Therefore, fiefs were fairly small and sought after, which also meant that it favored those with the most money, which was no way, which, you know, Knut proved. And Knut did good things. I'm not condemning him out of hand. But in England, initially, he was as destructive as William ever was, just without the religious switch. Now, he wrote down, and this no one ever seems to cite this, his passion, which is death, and his testament exists in a few sources. Now, I read it in Russian. I'm sure it's available in English somewhere in the book that I just cited. But he essentially, so, you know, most rulers, as they get into old age, write out their basic testament. This is called his passion. He wrote pieces of it, but it's very hard to tell after all these years. But the sources we have are pretty good. Olaf believed, you know, Olaf was born and raised in chaos and violence and oligarchy and slavery. Norway wasn't anything. Norway is never going to be an independent entity. There's never going to be an independent entity of any kind under these circumstances. It's simply going to be the will to power, which is something that the Vikings were very good at. But again, the Vikings never succeeded in creating any kind of a stable political order. For all these people who want to romanticize them without knowing the first thing, you know, they'd last about 2 minutes they did not create anything constructive. They did not have a state. That's why people like Fairhair came into existence. This is why Olaf came into existence. That model, which came out of necessity, was absolutely not sustainable, and they proved it through several centuries of chaos. The gospel appealed to Olaf in the same way that it appealed to St. Vladimir. He truly believed, near the end of his life, that the gospel could end the wars in Northern Europe, the emperor, the creation of the North Sea Empire as a one large fiefdom. And he also said, as I've hinted already, that idolatry, just like it was in the Old Testament, idolatry is an excuse for feudal rule. It's the nature of oligarchy, of plutocracy, of the pornocracy, of some of these cults that had been infiltrated by the, you know, Moloch and Astarte from the Middle East, the absolute worst of that world. And yet with all this, I mean, Olaf was, to think that people are going to stake their world and their reputation and their life on a religion they don't believe in is nonsense. Yeah, of course there was political implications. Everything has political implications. But he never missed, no matter what was going on, he never missed the services and he never missed fasting. He saw a brand new way of life and a brand new way of thought that didn't exist up until this point. And he put in, you know, he looked at Russia and corresponded that and put that up against and contrasted it to the world around him. And St. Vladimir was the exact same way. These guys are not going to die for something that they don't believe in. You know, they're not an American politician. You know, they're very different groups of people here. Throughout his entire life, whether it be in Russia or Richard or whoever may have, you know, brought about his conversion, mostly Russians, of course, he never stopped the services. He was always in attendance, even at great inconvenience to himself. He was convinced that God alone places rulers on the throne, because there is one natural order that flows through the entire world process. Norway, at the time, was extremely violent. And as I said before, the Viking movement, the raiding, came from noble overpopulation. And he does note, and it's also in his life of St. Olaf, that the cults of Sarte and Moloch, and this is, you know, again, not well known, I mean, we know this because they had sacred groves. Sacred groves are mentioned in the Old Testament. I came across this in some of these documents, and it was shocking because clearly it can't be a coincidence. It's the exact same ideology, the sacred groves you see in the Old Testament that the prophets cut down, dedicated to Astarte, Asmodeus, existed in Norway. So conversion, the bringing about of this, not necessarily a negation of everything like this, but its completion and bringing it to a new level of existence. Conversion meant the union of the crown. Notice I don't say the state. The union of the crown and the church, which blunted the power of the great lords. Very much like Knut created the earldom for the sake of checking the natives of Britain. For Olaf, bishops, they came mostly local, Northern Europe, many of them, you know, trained in the Western tradition. The Western Rite was done all the time here. This was not just a Russian province by any means. It was not. Bishops came from Sweden and Denmark. Bishops themselves and the great abbots became a check on the powerful as well. Now, Norway was based on a tribal social structure, which makes a lot of sense given the fact that everything is divided either through by rivers or mountains. There'd be herding, fishing, hunting. These were the sources of income. And it was never sufficient to satisfy this noble drive for power, and hence the Viking raids began. The tribes created a warrior aristocracy, and they formed larger alliances. held together by the Ding, or the what became the Parliament. Never was sufficient, however, to create a stable order. It was very unstable, and the leadership was never unified. Because you had chiefs that were separated by mountain ranges, the only real communication was done through the sea. This was the case under Fairhair and everyone since. Fairhair died in 872. But clearly, the same process was happening as the Anglo-Saxon world also struggled under Canute. As I said, the royal line had fled to Normandy after his invasion. And killing of the Edric in Britain was popular. Clearly, those nobles were not represented. And as I say, he maintained his power through high taxes, especially through the merchants of London. However, he was eventually, given the fact that he simply didn't have the numbers to dominate the country, the nobles of all types met at Oxford, as some of you know, and essentially decided the new state. And Canute was forced then and agreed to follow the laws of Edgar. Edgar the Great, centralizer, and great, you know, the successor of Alfred, in my opinion, in England. And England became, because of this, the model for Norway. Canute's empire was a rival of Olaf, but it didn't mean he thought that Canute was evil. Quite the contrary. The Oxford tradition with Canute became the model for what he tried to build there. And the model kind of went like this. It was a centralized state with a rational, impartial, but simple law code. He brought in a network of roughly 100 shire courts, watched over by the Witan, or the executive branch, or the executive council, I should say. He rejected feudalism. Nobles could not be fighting one another. He banned any kind of real castle construction, any fortification, which is, you know, the nature of that kind of feudalism. He had a network of sheriffs as agents of the crown, as sheriffs always were. And the army, if it's going to be raised, is going to come from the Witan, not a feudal muster. And he made it very clear that it is the crown alone that's allowed to coin money. But for any one of these rulers, everyone from Charlemagne to Vladimir to Canute to Olaf, you create a new ruling class that's dependent on you, and that's what the earls were for Canute. And the charter of Canute, we talked about at Christ Church, at Oxford, says a few things that eventually, you know, helped define Norway too. I mean, they're all really of the same general race and language. But Canute stated clearly that the martial life is a burden. Yes, the Viking life can never, ever, ever be romanticized. No different than the mafia life can be romanticized here. It's not. It's a terrifying burden that possessions, wealth, this creates sin. Canute was Orthodox too. And this was different, of course, when William came a bit later. Giving possessions away was far more significant as a moral matter than maintaining them. Wealth doesn't produce happiness, it produces more desires. And in Canute's case, and at the Oxford Christ Church charter, the church was to be more powerful than the state. I think that was just a matter of course. Anyway, that was just a matter of necessity. And then it was clear with Canute that Canterbury was going to be the head of the English royal church. So Canute, as someone who became the model for, and he died, I think, 5 years after Olaf, the Northern Empire, the North Sea Empire, was, you know, England, Norway, and Denmark. He, of course, was from Denmark. And that he was going to ally, not attack anymore, the great Anglo-Saxon nobles, so that those that he did not murder at that point. And of course, the Earl system number three, this new, very powerful executive office dependent on him. And unlike Olaf, though, Canute did want to make his alliance with not just Canterbury, but Rome too. Now, this is prior to the, you know, Gregory the Seventh. Rome didn't mean the same thing as it did then. But of course, Edgar's centralized law. Edgar's law was also influential in Norway. And that was going to be the standard by which Canute can be judged. And any kind of entry of that part of Britain into the North Sea Empire was going to have Edgar's law as its standard. So Olaf also borrowed the sheriff idea. The administration created the Housecarl, the military forces, the police forces under them, the house chaplains, and then the churls. Get the world. That's another version of earls, which was essentially the palace administration. And in 1024, a few years before his death, he imitated Canute with the Parliament of Munster, where he built his ecclesiastical structure once he was able to pacify the four. I mean, he was never fully stable, unfortunately, but he owned, controlled enough finance largely from the Baltics and parts of Russia with Russian soldiers in many cases. He built his ecclesiastical structure, his legal order, and church finance. And he, like St. Vladimir, was dedicated to a church that was completely independent. That was the form of the legal order. And Edgar's law was no different. I don't remember if years ago I did few lectures on Anglo-Saxon England many years ago on the Voice of Reason. I don't even know where those are now. And I deal with this at great length. And then he married later on Astrid of Sweden, which was a very good move on his part. He was able to maintain the peace from this and Christianize, in fact, both Norway at this point and much of Sweden. As I mentioned, after 1 year, he died in 1030, and violently, as he well knew was coming. And after 1 year, he was disinterred. Thousands were there. Thousands reported on this. His body was incorrupt. Yes, even in Norway, bodies decompose. He had a ruddy complexion, as I said, and his nails and hair grew. Now, his opponents, Elgiva, for example, said, well, you know, it's really cold up here, and that could keep a ruddy complexion in the body and keep it for a long time. And so that faction, several others in Sweden, refused to accept it. But, you know, Canute had five more years after, or at least 5 more years after Olaf's death. And given the sheer popularity and the rationality of Olaf's system, Canute was forced to accept and promote the cult of his former opponent, St. Olaf. And as I said before, the cult itself was far more important even than his actual institutions which never quite went away, and he became the central figure in what Norway was to be. And it wasn't long before Canute would rule Norway. He was, of course, governing England, very distracted by this, as everyone said. He ruled Norway for a few years. And it was Elgiva, of course, was connected to him and didn't want this to be true, that Olaf isn't just a great leader and a legislator, but was clearly chosen by God to do this. Canute did not have that benefit. And after the death of Olaf, that regency that was placed in power in Norway was not particularly popular. And actually, Magnus the Good, we all know as his, I think most sources consider him illegitimate, because he only got married later in life, finally laid claim to the throne. And the regency left by Canute was forced to flee. So the moral of this story is that this is how nations in Europe and elsewhere come into existence. Without the unifying force of a crown, number one, steeped in the tradition that they're trying to complete, finish, And the church that forms the content, the moral content, be family law, economics, the guild system, the services, all of this, which became the punctuation marks for not just the day, but for the year, is absolutely necessary. And of course, the economy makes it sufficient. A rational economy with a division of labor where everyone's working for everyone else, and the system of estates rather than straight up feudal classes, is both necessary and sufficient to create a functional nation. Nations, especially under these circumstances, are forged in blood, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. Warfare inherently isn't necessarily good or evil. Sometimes it's an absolute necessity. Pacifism, of course, is alien to the church, is alien to common sense, is alien to natural law, and a pacifist who refuses to defend his people is responsible for their destruction. So there's no getting out of it. So pacifism is inherently contradictory because it permits other people to be violent and to do far more damage than they normally would if you had done something. Pacifism is an ideology that's purely negative. It comes into existence because they don't like something that's existing at the moment. They universalize this emotional outburst. But you realize, you know, pacifists are usually extremely violent people individually. And once their people have any kind of power, now all of a sudden they become authoritarians. You don't know how many anarchists. My master's thesis advisor claimed to be an anarchist who ruled that department with an iron fist. Anarchism was a symbol. It was this great negation, which he didn't believe for 5 seconds. You know, when they get a big paycheck, all of a sudden, you know, they're not so radical anymore. Or they institutionalize radicalism, making it their, you know, Soviet psychiatric hospital. But these ideologies don't create nations. They create parasitic structures. The fact that Olaf explicitly talked about the interdependence of functions and estates to create a functional nation where state and nation or culture would be interconnected rather than having one dominate the other, or the state usually dominates, and the church being the spokesperson, and the monks especially, because they create bishops, spokesperson for the nation, speaking their own language and coming from the tradition of the locality, unlike the Roman church, which brought everything from central Italy. Everything, of course, was done in the local languages, and the Western white rite, generally speaking, was the dominant form of worship under St. Olaf there. The Russians also had a presence. But remember, back then, you didn't have these rites as sealed off from one another. It didn't work that way. They were often intermingled. There is an Uppsala Missal, which is kind of semi-Western rite, semi-Eastern rite. These border areas, thanks to people like St. Olaf, you have the same thing in places like Yugoslavia. So the Western Rite being a dominant form of Orthodox worship with plenty of Eastern accretions, and there's nothing wrong with that. The Liturgy of St. Peter, which I haven't talked about in a long time, which I actually did for a while, have this legitimate mixture. Back then, you didn't have this hermetically sealed East versus West in terms of ritual. That developed probably only after the Fourth Crusade, and when the Crusaders sacked Amalfion on Athos, the Benedictine monastery on Athos. So, anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I think that this doesn't just cover Norway, Scandinavia, it covers the Christian nation in general and where they have to develop. Norway traces its national ethnic tradition from St. Olaf in this very beginning of the start of the second millennium. Thank you everyone. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.